Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Siv. I got a little nervous this morning about getting up here when I saw the discussions that were going on, and I hope I don't complicate things even more. I know I might. No, just nothing but trends. Thanks to Kurt Stewart also, who helps fund our research, and this is exactly the kind of atmosphere that we have in workshops, in Brainchild workshops, and it's really good. So thanks. I also want to point out a lot of this work. This is just kind of a review and an evolution how I've been thinking and how I've been trying to apply the cellular changes in the sponge to pertinent aspects of modeling. And I admit at the outset, I'm not sure what the pertinent aspects are. But I at least want to give you a flavor for the kinds of things that are happening to the sponge, which I'm not saying that we're trying overtly to ignore them, but hopefully we can consider them. I'm very much looking forward to Susan Margulies' talk, and the talk this morning by Richard was fantastic about it. We're starting to learn something about the elasticity and some of the mechanical properties of these cells. This is really going to tie things up. But I especially want to thank Janet Miller, who was my postdoc and grad student, and she always was pretty independent, but she's officially independent at Central Michigan University now. And Jia Li, who's with us today, has done a lot of good work in our lab. So as I approached this, I started thinking, well, what is it, you know, what's wrong with using the brain simply as a sponge? I know that some of these constants have to be fairly simple in these equations, but you know, what are we forgetting about? A sponge, as we've talked this morning, pretty freely permeable. We also don't take into consideration yet anyway that it changes with age. I know I have to throw my old sponges away after about 3 months. But we haven't thought about that too much. I'm going to just show you some examples in untreated and in shunted hydrocephalus of the cellular changes that may or may not impact the viscoelastic properties. We really haven't considered regional differences within the sponge, and I think they exist within the brain. We have learned a lot in the last 20 or 25 years, though. If we think of hydrocephalus as slowly progressive trauma to the brain, regardless of whether it occurs early or in an aged brain, so it would be good if we could factor that in. So as I said before, I'm just going to try to summarize and give you some examples of what we should be thinking about when we think about the constant of the sponge. There are problems, there are just as many complications in studying the pathophysiology of hydrocephalus as there are in trying to tweak your equations. This is a very difficult disease because there are all kinds of different etiologies and injury mechanisms. Most likely the injury mechanisms overlap in time, at least. I'll show you some examples of secondary mechanisms, which is mostly what we look at and, you know, after the fact, after the ventricles have begun to enlarge. The clinicians would remind us not to forget about the fact that we have really repetitive ventricular megaly every time we have a shunt malfunction. The age differences are probably considerable. So it's very important to look at the different animal models that we use and remember how old the brain is or how mature the brain is. I alluded to the regional effects. So much has been learned from the pathophysiology of the neocortex, but I don't believe that the entire brain is the cerebral neocortex. So we should remember that as well. So with that in mind, I just want to skip a few stones across here, and this would be a summary slide, if you will, of the kinds of cellular damage that we see. And as I said before, we're mostly looking at these things that happen after the fact. Some good work being done now in ischemia. There's a lot of work that has been done before in edema. As I said before, the whole elasticity, being able to measure this, I think is going to be very, very important. This is still an open question, I believe, and how much cell death is really important, whether it's to modeling or whether it's to functional deficits in the brain. We know that all of these occur, but their relative importance has still not been worked out. I'm going to highlight gliosis and show you some examples about how it could affect the mechanical properties of the brain as well as the functions of the cerebrovascular system. So I'll try to get on with that. But I also want to mention a few things about the other cellular and structural things that occur. This is certainly there certainly are regional differences. And all I want to do is point out that, for example, in the hippocampus, where you may or may not see cell death, we've seen in our experimental models a lot of cytologic edema, but the interstitial spaces are very tight. In contrast to the cerebral cortex, where the interstitial spaces really expand. We kind of forget about the thalamus, but I'm going to show you some examples of some gliosis that is relatively, quote, distant to the lesion, if you consider the cerebral cortex as being where the lesion occurs. We don't know very much at all about the pathophysiology, or at least the cytopathology that occurs in some of these brainstem structures. We're starting to work with Miles Johnston here on lymphatics, but boy, we haven't touched on that at all, and I won't have time to do that either. So, the reason to show this is to say, this is from Hazel Jones' work with Neil Harris quite a while ago in a congenital model, so a neonatal onset hydrocephalus, that shows that it takes a while for cells to die. The white bars are the controls, and the black bars are the hydrocephalic animals from a variety of different cortical regions. And it's not until 30 days that you start to see statistically significant decreases of the numbers of neurons. So it is a slowly progressive disorder. Mark Delbizio did some very good work using tunnel techniques to identify apoptotic cells that are dying from programmed cell death. And one way to look at this is to say, just as Hazel did, that it takes about 3 weeks after the induction of hydrocephalus before there's a statistically significant increase in the number of apoptotic cells. But if you look at this a little more carefully, and Mark points this out, this is 29 cells in an entire rat brain section. So that's 29 cells out of thousands of neurons. So that may be a statistically significant stereology finding, but is it a functionally significant finding? We're not sure of that yet.
Is that corrected for wet weight, dry weight, or for volume of brain tissue in that setting?
It's corrected for area of brain. That's true. So it's cells per unit area, but you draw all the way around the entire cerebral cortex and literally count every single cell in there and rank them as either apoptotic or normal.
But if it were compacted,
right,
then it could be that there were no more dead cells.
Right.
But all you're seeing is the compaction.
That's right. And that's why, thank you, Hal, that's why... He brings up a very important point. When you see some of these cell density studies, if you look early on, sometimes you see an increase in cell density. The cell density is your parameter, and you haven't corrected for shrinkage of tissue. There's a compaction of cells. This shows that even with compaction, there is a decrease in the number of cells. But it's a really important point. Yeah.
What's the cause of death?
What is the cause of death? That is highly debatable. It can be metabolic. I don't have a slide to show you, but Hazel has shown that using MR spectroscopy, that within 2 or 3 days of ventricular enlargement, you get a decrease in energy metabolites, and then you start to get decreases in neurotransmitters and neuromodulators. So it could simply be a metabolic effect. It's still debatable as to whether or not ischemia plays a role, even though cerebral blood flow is decreased throughout the brain. I believe that, and again, see, this is progressive. As the ventricles expand and you begin to stretch some of the paraventricular white matter, compress and stretch it, you start to stretch axons. I'm going to show you some data on connectivity. And so now you've got a retrograde effect, and you could literally be exotomizing cells in the cortex. So now you're looking at retrograde cell death after their axons have already been chopped off. In a developing system, it could be that the pathways haven't found the appropriate target, and so that could be the cause of that apoptotic cell death. Those are a few of the major ones. Well, neurons don't have to die in order to have some kind of a change. And long ago, Neil Harris and Hazel Jones and I did a good old-fashioned Golgi-impregnated stain of dendrites. And here you can see that in untreated hydrocephalus, apical dendrites are significantly reduced in number and in length. If we shunt these animals early, you can recover these branches. If you shunt late, you can't. And it affects both the apical dendritic tree and the basal dendritic tree. So the neurons can still be alive, but they've lost some of their fine process.
Pat, I reviewed that article a bunch of times, and the problem with it is that your early shunted animals had a lot longer survival time.
That is true.
Than the late shunted, so that you had... They get 3 weeks to get better rather than 1 week
to get
better.
So
yeah.
It's true. Well, we have the data. We haven't published it. It's very important to allow the recovery period to be the same amongst the different groups. That's what he's pointing out. So it's very true. It's probably if we waited 10 more days, I think there was only a 10-day difference here, it's possible that could have come back up. You're right. This is just a reminder that even though you don't see it pathologically, connections are screwed up. We did a track tracing study of projections from the motor cortex, cortical fugal projections, and in the normal condition here, this gray area, these represent all axonal terminals in the thalamic relay nuclei, and the dots represent cells that were labeled that project to the cortex. And in untreated hydrocephalus, there's a tremendous decrease in the amount of synaptic terminals and some decrease in the number of cells. And successful shunting, it's very quickly, this is right, this is a very, very short post-shunt recovery period, you don't recover these cells right away anyway, or these connections right away. I'd like to move on to gliosis because I think this does have an impact on your modeling. We know from experimental animals that residual gliosis occurs. This is in an animal that was successfully shunted, and I believe this is about 51 days after the shunt was placed. So the ventricles came back down to relatively normal size, and all of this is gliotic white matter with cysts in the white matter. Janet, as part of her thesis, used a variety of ways to quantify astrocytosis. In this case, this is just expression of glial fibrillary acidic protein in the HTX rat. And you can see that beginning fairly early, there are increases in GFAP. They become statistically significant at 3 weeks of age. They're still statistically significant here. Shunting in this case, brings them back a little bit. This is a little bit longer recovery period, and we're starting to get some increase in GFAP here. But so there's an idea. I don't think that it's been proven that gliosis is permanent or the residual gliosis in this situation. I'll just show you a couple of examples from what I think we know are important areas within the brain. This is from our model of basal cistern obstructed extraventricular hydrocephalus. I didn't do that just to make you happy, Hal. I do think we should start using that term. Anyway, we're going to look first right here at this dorsolateral angle. And this is a GFAP stain for reactive astrocytes. The controls here look like this. And this is within 2 or 3 weeks, I think, afterwards, you see a tremendous increase in reactive astrocytes. You see a similar increase in the caudate putamen. Here's the ventricle, so you start to see some reactive astrocytosis, possibly stiffening that part of the wall. You see it also in the paraventricular white matter. This is a dramatic change in the number and the reactivity of these astrocytes. And we saw some beautiful pictures this morning. This is just another reminder of the same thing, that reactive astrocytosis is occurring. There's the dorsolateral angle of the frontal horn. So it's occurring in areas that are predicted to have high stress and strain. But gliosis occurs distant from the lesion. Jack? Is slit like normal or is it slit like abnormal?
Well, my point is you can have huge ventricles and come all the way down to slit ventricles.
Okay.
And these kids, you know, they may be functioning at a pretty high level.
Well, this is biased, I know, but I could back it up, I think, if I had a little more time. I think that depending on how long the brain was not treated, so how long there was either strain or compression or there was a decrease in cerebral blood flow, there were ischemic situations, if that lasted for, I'm going to take a guess at a month or more, there would be some residual metabolic and structural deficits. Whether or not they catch up, I don't know how long it takes for them to catch up. But in the short recovery period that we allow our animals to have, they don't always catch up. Well, we don't know. Yeah, he did.
He'd show that there wasn't a change.
A long-term change. Well, he took some human biopsy specimens. I can't remember the clinical situation for those. All I want to do is point out here that depending on the stain you use, you can see these clusters. These are highly activated microglia that have progressed to the stage of being phagocytic. So they are starting to clean up debris, performing their normal function. But here's a cluster in a very compressed hydrocephalic cortex. The ventricle is down here. There's practically no white matter along here. There's some macrophages lining the ventricle. You know, whether that is a stiffening point, I would love to see some elasticity studies where, you know, that was that little ball that was in the middle and see some of those waves that might be affected by that. But also, down in the quite a ways, 2-3 centimeters in a cat away, these are the cortical fugal fibers in the crus cerebri, and there are activated microglia there as well, and also in the lateral geniculate nucleus of the relay thalamus. So gliosis occurs quite a bit away from the cerebral cortex and the paraventricular white matter. And
is that the product of Wallerian degeneration?
Yes, it could.
The fibers that pass close to the ventricles that will...
Right. It could be highly, highly secondary to the axonal degeneration, or the demyelination, for that matter. We were kind of surprised when Janet showed us this. This is from her thesis. The two controls are here. You just have two different ages of animals. You're looking at the cerebral aqueduct. This is a pretty important structure, I gather, from this morning, and from some of the collaborations we've done with Mike and Mark. Here is an increase. These red cells are all astrocytes. The green cells are microglia. And here's after shunting. There's literally an increase in the number of microglia that line this plastic aqueduct. You see it here as well. And they're not just in the tissue. They're right on the ventricular lining of the aqueduct itself. Okay. Now, that's a good question.
It would also be very interesting.
I don't think it's ILB expression. I mean, maybe that is right there, because there you can clearly see the ependymal lining. Here's a normal ependymal lining, and I guess I would have expected seeing a little more in the controls. Is that what you mean, Joe?
Yeah, well, no, they think that's what's been induced.
Yeah.
The production of hydrocephalus, not necessarily that those are, maybe a small point, but it's it means that would be a change in the biology of the natural ependymal cells that you would be showing.
True. That's true. I'm still perplexed about why it either gets worse or there's something else going on. You know, why does it hang around after successful shunting?
You know, after shunting, it's not that uncommon for secondary.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, I want to use this to springboard to what I think will prove to be a very important functional relationship between glial cells and cerebrovascular modulation. It's clear that we're all interested in cerebrovascular modulation here for a variety of reasons, whether it's CSF absorption or whether it's wind Kessel or pulsatility. But so this is just to remind you what Jim and his group showed many years ago about decreases in cerebral blood flow. You can't see them very well, but the white bars that are in here are in the untreated hydrocephalic animals, and you can see that there are decreases in cerebral blood flow primarily in the white matter, frontal horn white matter, corpus callosum, but not in the cortical gray. Structurally, this is what seems to happen to the capillary beds in hydrocephalus. You can see these casts in the controls, whether it's in the gray matter or whether it's in the white matter. You can see there's a tremendous reduction in the number of microvessels. There's disorientation of those microvessels. We've seen this too, that even though you lose the fine microvessels, some of the vessels that are left seem to actually enlarge. Shunting, neovascularization can take place, neoangiogenesis can take place, but this is not always a perfectly organized, normal capillary bed. So we know that those microvessel changes take place. All this is just a reminder that we've seen in experimental cats this occurring both in the deep layer, so this would be white matter right here, and also in superficial gray all the way up to layer 2 and layer 3. So I don't think that the capillary changes are restricted just to the paraventricular white matter. All right, this is where I wanted to get to, and this is just my reminder more to myself that we now know that astrocytes, primarily through a COX-1 signaling mechanism, can create vasodilation. So all this is a reminder of how important the astrocytes are, whether they proliferate or not. This is a nice study, fairly recent, from Macon Niedergaard's lab, showing labeling these long astrocytic processes that penetrate the pia or start in the superficial layers and extend all the way down. Here they are at higher magnification. Here's a labeled one that's in very close proximity to a microvessel with possibly some structural connections between that astrocytic footplate, if you will, and that vessel. Here's just another way to look at it. You can see some of these. This is a triple label for this. You can see where the astrocytes are with GFAP in green. You can see where these COX-1 cells are all along this penetrating probably arterial to there. Anyway, not COX-2 positive. And what's really interesting is that if you use some uncaging techniques, you can stimulate these astrocytes. What you're seeing here is a cross-section of a capillary with an astrocyte labeled here. It's lighting up because it's been stimulated, and so you see an increase in calcium. And what they did was literally measure the lumen of that vessel after a UV stimulation of that particular astrocyte. And here you see a graph of the progression of that. This is the calcium peak right here, and here is the increase in the lumen of the capillary. So it's a beautiful experiment, but also a really good example of the interaction between astrocytes and blood vessels. Whether that occurs as part of a Windkessel, I'm not sure. You saw this morning, but it's certainly worth considering. And I'm going to close with this idea that has come from Jerry Silverberg and Ed Stolpe, Conrad Johansson, and Petra Klinge. They've been looking at clearance mechanisms. And Jerry, of course, has put forth the idea that in NPH there's similar clearance deficits as there are in Alzheimer's disease. And the lab at Brown and at Stanford are looking at this transporter, this LRP1 transporter, which removes amyloid beta protein from the neuropil. They're also looking at this RAGE transporter that transports A-beta out of the microvessels into the neuropil. And I stole this from Jerry. But what you see quite nicely here, and these are in hydrocephalic animals, the controls on this side, where after 6 weeks of hydrocephalus, you go from a control situation where here you see LRP1 positive labeling in normal vessels, along normal vessels, and it doesn't appear. It may be a little bit there, but it's the transporter to remove the A-beta protein is not there in hydrocephalus. And again, this could play a major a role in clearance mechanisms in the cerebral vasculature. So just to sum up, I certainly would like to see the mechanical properties of some of the tissue modeled a little more accurately. And I think in the next 2 or 3 years we should be able to get to that and factor that into some of the modeling equations that we use. I think that glia will be an important player, not just because they may make that region or that surface of the ventricle stiffer. I'm not sure that they will. We're trying in our lab to correlate that, correlate the cellular changes with the with compliance and some of the biomechanical properties, but also cerebrovascular modulation. I've talked about this. I haven't talked at all about this, but I think the aquaporins in terms of water transit are going to be really important. Let's not forget that the pediatric brain and the young adult brain, especially as children with hydrocephalus transition into adulthood, that all of these parameters may be changing quite a bit. I didn't say much about plasticity, but I know that it goes on even in an untreated brain, which is going to change the properties of the sponge. And as I said before, I think these studies are really, really important. So Jim will have me sit down, and enough. I especially want to thank Janet and Gia again. a lot of this work was hatched at a brainchild workshop about 3 years ago out in Utah. And only one of the reasons that I've moved out there as of 2 weeks or so ago. So I thank all of those people, and I especially thank Kurt again and his whole family for funding this and just being so passionate about trying to find a cure for this. Thanks a lot.